In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
どこいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ。どこにいるのかな。見えない。
こんな
と
こだ。
What's good, internet? It is Monday, June 25th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 166. I'm your host, Austin Walker, and joining me today, Danielle Riendo, here in the studio.
Hello. Here Hi. In the studio.
How's it going?
It's good. It's a beautiful day. It was a beautiful pride.
It was a beautiful pride. It's a beautiful day. It's the right amount of heat without being too hot. It's like good sun, but not too much heat.
Yeah.
Also joining us, Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
Is it warm there?
Yeah, I mean, it is summertime.
That's okay.
And you're in the Northeast. But it has been unusually gorgeous. They keep saying there's going to be a heat wave, but they keep pushing it back.
Ooh.
So I'm trying to suck up every last day of mild sunshine and partial clouds. I went hiking the other day. It was great.
Oh,
awesome. Patrick, is it raining in Chicago? Is it snowing? What's happening in Chicago?
Three squirrels and counting. Is what's
Three
happening.
Squirrels.
Three squirrels.
Three squirrels. I think we're.
Is that a season?
Yeah, it is right now. It's the season that cost me $75 a squirrel on top of my roof. That's the season. That
squirrel
I'm
season's my favorite Young Thug album.
Squirrel season is expensive.
Wait, you could pay a Huckabee $5 to shoot him with a rifle. Just sit out there hey, you want to kill some animals?
Sit out there Betty Draper.
God.
Bop. God.
$5.
I'll show this squirrel some civility.
How's everybody doing? Is everyone feeling civil today? Civil conversation? Are we ready to...
Anything but.
Oh, my God. We can't get into it. We'd just be the whole hour. It would be us just being did you fucking see? Can you believe? Did you read?
The gall.
God, I'm so frustrated with the world. But I'm not frustrated. Video games. There's a lot of them. I think we've all been playing a bunch of them. Who's been playing some new stuff? Anybody?
Someone's phone? Hello?
Is that an 80s sitcom?
I believe that's a postal locksmith. Hold on.
Okay.
Oh, that's Rob.
Of course.
A postal locksmith?
Of course Rob has an 80s sitcom as his postal locksmith song.
What's a postal locksmith? Do the post officers, is what I just said. I'm painting a very post-apocalyptic picture. What is a postal locksmith? The internet's not helping me with this.
That doesn't sound like a real phrase. I've never heard that phrase
but
before.
But he said it with such...
And I believe Rob. Rob's not... I mean, Rob's a lot of things, but... Hey, Rob.
Hi, welcome back.
What's a postal locksmith?
So, when you live in a building, you can't just call a locksmith to come sort out your mailbox if your lock gets busted.
Okay.
Because otherwise, what's to stop you from, say you want to snoop on a neighbor, or it's not even your apartment, it's someone you're stalking. So you don't want people to just be able to call up a locksmith and be like, oh, I can't get into my mailbox. Can you just come here and crack this thing open? So you have to go through the post office to get a locksmith to come to your place. And they charge you a reasonable amount of money.
$75 a squirrel.
Yeah,
pretty much. But then they're a little iffy on scheduling.
I have a question. Did you know it was a postal locksmith because it was J-pop elevator music playing?
Is
that what they sound like?
No, that was just a default ringtone that is obnoxious enough to get my attention.
Gotcha. Okay.
But yeah, usually I keep my phone off all the time. This is the one day I didn't want to miss a call. And of course, they chose that moment.
Perfect.
Rather than 11 a.m., which was when they were supposed to call.
It is. It is 3 p.m., so,
you're right on time.
Well, not the only ones running late.
Yeah. So video games. We going to talk about some? How are they doing? People playing new ones?
I played a happy game.
What'd you play?
Well, it wasn't all happy, but it was wistful.
Okay.
I played a wistful game.
What'd you play?
I played Don't Nod's latest.
Vampire.
The Awesome Adventure.
No, not Vampire. They put out another new game.
Even more recent.
Okay.
They put out two games this month.
They
That's
did.
Banana Pants. Okay.
Was that the third one? Banana Pants?
Banana Pants, yeah. The Awesome Adventures of Banana Pants. It's about a little boy who wears banana pants. He's Captain Banana. That's his superhero.
I would believe you if you said this was true. You play...
This is basically the game, right?
It really is, actually.
So wait, what is it actually called again?
Okay, it is called The Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit.
Okay.
It is a Life is Strange, sort of a miniature prequel-y, not necessarily a prequel. I don't want to spoil anything about the story, obviously.
Okay.
But what we saw at E3 is, you know, a good chunk of the game, and we already talked about that a little bit, but it's essentially...
They have said you'll be introduced to, like, themes and potential characters of Life is Strange 2, which they just announced is the first episode starts in September.
Yes. Yeah, this is meant as a love letter to the fans and or an entry point for new people to play the series, basically. And you play as a little boy named Chris. He's about 10 or 11, I think, somewhere in there.
I have a kid, and I don't know how to do children's ages, so don't feel bad.
Exactly.
Looking,
like that he's could, 27.
He could be 7. He could be 13. Yeah, right. Like, I don't know the difference, and I should know better. So don't fumble your words when you're trying to figure out what a kid's age is. Because
Fair enough. He lives with his dad, and he has a very powerful imagination. He really likes superheroes, and his alter ego is Captain Spirit, who is like a badass, you know, very traditional superhero.
Like
he has a lot of powers.
Type
yeah,
character.
He's like a Superman-y guy, and he can bend matter to his will. That's his superpower. So he can manipulate objects, make things fly, you know, bust bad guys, kill them, I guess.
Wow. Wait, he kills people?
I mean, he kills bad, evil spirits.
Okay.
Like,
so is this like a puzzle-solving thing where you're like... Changing
less,
matter to solve puzzles or to like explore, or
it's a little bit more exploratory. They call it a sandbox, like a small,
is it
a finite sandbox? It is kind of, because you can go through all kinds of little adventures with him, and there's like an end state, there's an end game.
Okay,
but you can actually sort of go in and do all the adventures and all the sort of little side questy things. Basically, he's hanging around his house on a Saturday morning with his dad. His dad gets drunk and watches the game. There is clearly some sort of drama going on.
Sure.
They hint at a few things, a few possibilities. Mom is not in the picture anymore. I think mom has died in some horrible fashion. I haven't done every single little thing.
Sure.
But that's very, very strongly hinted at very, very beginning.
Is it a situation where, when I think about like Life is Strange, that's a game that's often about regret or about wishing you could change things, wishing you could do things a different way. Does this have a similar like thematic through line?
Oh, yeah. Yes,
absolutely. What is that thematic through line?
I think the dad is not the happiest person
and
wishes maybe some things could be different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, like the kid is like, I wish I could change the world to be better. Okay.
He wishes he could be powerful and change the world to be better.
That's sad. That's good.
But it's really – I think it's really well done. It's very short. You can get through it in about an hour, and then you can kind of go and if you want to find some of the extra stuff. There's actually like a really cute little quest list, but it's called My Awesome Adventures, and it fills in as if he drew it with crayon, like when he did something. Like, there is a quest, I'll say this part, where you need to assemble all the pieces of Captain Spirit's outfit so that he can have superpowers and use his imagination to do things like go into a scary room and fight a scary monster.
Right.
But it's really, he's doing chores, he's doing things like cleaning up the house, he's doing things like helping with the laundry, and also having like cool adventures with various objects.
Awesome.
So it's very cute, very somber in some ways, certainly. There's a lot that's hinted at, and there are a lot of hints about sort of the previous game and the previous universe, and there were a lot of hints about, what could be happening in the next game. So, yeah.
Cool.
Really cool. Really cool. It's free,
now, because
and it's
I
out
am
now.
A child of the 90s, and I have a cultural reference point that's, like, you know, an inch wide, basically. Like, when I looked at this, I was like... This seems like maybe it owes a lot to Spaceman Spiff in Calvin and Hobbes.
Sure.
Like, what if somebody like made an entire game about sort of Calvin's inner life? Is there that element, or is it more about the juxtaposition of reality versus the kid's fabulism?
Yeah, I mean, that's in there a little bit. I think Calvin and Hobbes is a really good sort of reference point. Although Chris is not nearly as like sardonic as Calvin, and he's not nearly as like hilarious little consumerist versus, you know, Hobbes's very anti-materialist humanist sort of perspective. So it's not really working on that level necessarily, but there is a lot of it that is oh, is this imagination or is this actually real? Is this actually how he sees the world? It's definitely playing with that quite a bit. And it ends on, like, again, I won't spoil anything. It ends on a satisfying note.
Cool.
And is just a cool little adventure.
And they have not said anything about what Life is Strange 2 looks like yet, right? This doesn't, like, end with, like, a bigger teaser about Life is Strange 2 at all?
I don't think so. This feels like a side story that relates to that game. And that's sort of, I think, how they posited it. I have the review guide up here. And I think, that's kind of what they call it. It's,
basically,
don't spoil anything.
They basically said that, like, this will give you insight into some of, like, what they're thinking about for Life is Strange 2. And I think they said, like, the game will get fully unveiled in August, which conveniently times to Gamescom, which is then a month from the launch of that game in September. But I haven't had a chance to play through the whole thing. I only did the bit that we talked about for E3. I will say, like, it felt like they're stretching their arms thematically, but it feels very much like it has the same, like, Life is Strange, sort of melancholy, nostalgic, like, teen drama, but, like, in a good way, sort of, like, it's earnest and emotional in a way that a lot of games aren't, and not in an ironic sense, and this seems to keep in line with that. I thought Before the Storm was kind of rocky quality-wise, but I enjoyed... I just like the setup of those games and how they play and how they interact and just their sense of humor, where even when it's extremely, like, cheesy, it's cheesy in a way that's like, aw. Like, it feels earnest and earned in a way that's very difficult to pull off. Like, it's easier to, like, most games are cheesy and then fall flat, or most writing is cheesy and falls flat, but I think this is actually cheesy because it comes from, like, an earned place, and there seems to be more of that, and I'm hopeful that we'll get some actual sort of... I'm excited to see them play in a different world. I'm really glad that it's the same universe, because I like the nods. I want to know what happened to the characters from the first game, but I was not interested in sort of seeing, like, a sequel with them that's like, oh, and they find new powers, and they're forced in a new situation with those powers. I'm glad that they're kind of just a anthology makes a lot of sense for the type of game they built the first time around. So I'm curious to see more of it. I'm going to play the PC version tonight, because... we got Xbox code on Friday, like, not to be a snob, but, like, I the choices, like, mean a lot to me. And so I was like, well, I'll just wait for the PC version, which is free. They're all free. And then so all my choices will carry over for... Cool. 'Cause they said some things you make a decision on in this will carry over in some way to Life is Strange 2. So I got to make sure I've got
I can see how they will connect it. So
interesting.
Yeah, I played it on Xbox. It was...
I guess you got to play Life is Strange 2 on Xbox.
I like my Xbox,
replay
so,
it on,
you know.
On PC.
Yeah, I might do both. It's fine. Cool. It's an hour long. Like, it's a
that's
cool
okay.
little thing.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Who else is playing something new? I know Hollow Knight dropped on Switch. Patrick, have you put some real time into that?
Yeah, I played maybe, like, 30 minutes of Hollow Knight when it came out on the PC, because it looked like my kind of thing, and I will give almost any sort of Metroid influence game a shot, but... it just didn't click, I don't think it was that it didn't click. I just didn't have the time to put into it to really wrap my head around it. Uh-huh. And then it just kind of got shuffled to the side, as so many other games do. And, like, I had an increased agitation over most of 2017, which was a Switch version was announced pretty early, but then it kept getting delayed. Like, they were just still working on it and still working on it. And that's a game that I thought, like, I had a pretty... I was suspicious that it would have been pretty high on my Game of the Year list had I given it, like, its proper due.
Right.
But I really wanted to play it on Switch because I had heard it was also not a short game. It was like this is a game that we're talking 20, 30, 40 hours, especially with the DLC. And so it's like, okay, like, in my life, like, I can do those games, but I can fit in more of them if it's on Switch because I can find 20 minutes here or 30 minutes there in my life. And so I was like, I'm going to wait for the Switch version. And so I was actually able to sit down this weekend and play a couple of hours. And the thing that really intrigued me was I cannot, unfortunately, credit whoever said this on Twitter, but someone described the game as one of the first games to actually take the lessons of Dark Souls instead of just aping Dark Souls, which I think is a very curious way of positing the influence of a game. Like Dark Souls, where I think a lot of games have taken, animation priority and, like, difficulty and like and outright like Neo just taking the exact framework mm-hmm. and putting it in a different setting with some twists. But there's like a difference between taking the lessons of Dark Souls and taking so like whole cloth mechanically how it is built.
Right.
I'm not sure if I'm far enough.
Can
to
you
sort
speak
of...
about what that actually means
no,
in play?
No, I can't. I can't. I'm still. That's what I'm very curious to. I mean, there are some ways that I can speak to that, which is that mechanically it shares some similarities. When you're collecting a currency that you can use to purchase things in shops and to upgrade your character, that stuff is dropped when you die. Then you have to go back, and in this one, you have to kill a little thing that you've left behind, like a little soul or whatever. It floats around the room from where you did die, and you have to attack it twice in order to get that stuff back. So in the pursuit of getting the experience you've dropped, you can die and thus lose that experience, mm-hmm. which is an interesting quirk. And the thing, there's a lot of Dark Souls type storytelling, I'll say. It's a lot of sort of like oblique like details, hints at world building without being as explicit as a lot of games are. In terms of the actual combat, one of the more interesting battles I had was one of this who seems like a boss but ends up just being sort of this regular enemy. He just feels like a boss the first time you encounter them because you have no idea how to defeat them, but then once you realize the trick, then it's like extremely simple, and then they just become like a regular enemy that you come across going forward. Like the game understands that, like, aha, you have figured out what to do with this creature, like now you shouldn't have any trouble. And like specifically, the way it picks up on souls is like there are very specific animations and there are very specific tells for the character, but in a Metroid style game you're often on the offensive, you're kind of always like pushing on the enemy and like dodging projectiles. And what you learn from this enemy type is that if you jump over them, if you like hold back, like you're not actually finding, it's always got a shield up. There's no way to kind of get in like a meaningful attack. And then what I discovered upon like the fourth, fifth, sixth time I was fighting was that occasionally I would see it like attack me and there'd be a small window where I could jump over and attack it from the back. But it wasn't clear how I repeated that. And so the puzzle of the fight was figuring out, okay, this is not actually about dodging. This is not actually all that much about timing. It was actually about kind of unlocking the puzzle of this creature's movement. And what it ended up being was you just stand in front of it, and then you give it about 4 or 5 seconds, and then, boom, it tries to go for an attack, which it's locked into, which is the window to jump over, stab it in the back. And then the solution to the enemy is just repeating that
eight times. Which is a video, which is like an NES-style solution in some ways, but like when it's packaged with the rest of that kind of Soulsian structure, suddenly takes on some new life. I think I can credit two different people with your thing of Hollow Knight is the Souls like to take the correct lessons from Dark Souls. One, it could be Gary Butterfield, who did Bonfireside Chat. They had a podcast about that, and that little line got passed around a lot. Two, it could also have been Bruno Diaz, who wrote about this game for us at the end of the year last year and made the case that Hollow Knight is to Souls-likes what Spelunky is to roguelikes, which is that it translates something deeper than just core mechanics and like learns some lessons and brings it to a new format. And in making that translation to a new genre, it's actually getting deeper at what the heart of the genre is, if that makes sense. Like going from like a top-down, you know, roguelike thing in to a 2D side scroller in Spelunky, you kind of get to like some of the core ideas about what a roguelike or a roguelite is. And the same way he was making the case that like by getting rid of the third-person action stuff, your Hollow Knight is able to kind of emphasize some of the other aspects of the Souls-like games in ways that's more than just now it's sci-fi, now it's Souls but it's Vikings, now it's Souls but it's samurai. And I'm not taking away from any of the games that do those other things, but his case is basically like by turning it into something that isn't just another third person action game, you're able to kind of see some of the qualities that are deeper than just the moment to moment interaction, that are about design, that are about aesthetic, that are about like a sort of attitude of design. It's worth checking that piece out. Excited to now listen to the Bonfireside Chat episode on Hollow Knight also.
It's a great game.
Or a third person could have told you that. A lot of it seems to be an idea that's in the air.
I think it was a third person, but okay. It sounds like that's something in the air about that game. And that like expanded explanation is very much in line with like what I had seen and what got me. I was like, that was scratching at the back of my head, and I was like, okay, like I've wanted to play this, but now I'm actually gonna like put in the time, like let it get its hooks in me so that I have to keep pressing forward. And one thing I will give, like, fair warning, like, one thing that is consistent with Souls, like, not that this is exclusive to Souls, like, this game is hard. Like, it is not an easy game. I think there are a lot of Metroid-style games that I would call them challenging as opposed to, like, actively and earnestly difficult. And this one is very much like, we're going to bat you around. Like, we're gonna push you around. You're going to hit walls in which you're really going to have to... like dig deep and like study precise like what's happening in front of you, and that's not going to be for anyone. Like I was going through this morning a bunch of like different like subreddits I check, and like there was one like very popular one on like the Nintendo Switch subreddit was like, y'all, Hollow Knight is not the game that I thought it was, and like one of the big like threads there was about people like not quite understanding sort of like the depth of the challenge in the game, because that is, it is not just, some Metroid inspired games are very exploration based and the combat is more just like hurdles you have to get through in pursuit of the exploration. Like this is very much a hardcore exploration game in addition to being a hardcore combat game. And the exploration stuff is really interesting because when the game opens, you like, there's no sense of what you're supposed to do. Like the game just says like, There's like a world underneath where you're standing. Like, I don't know. Like, go explore it, I guess. And you just start killing things and you start collecting a currency. You don't have a map.
Right.
About like 45 minutes of the game, you will just stumble upon by accident, you know, or like, you know, I'm sure it's like slightly guided by the level design, but feels like you're stumbling on by accident, a map maker.
Right.
And then he sells you a map for that area. But then crucially, one of like the really smart, very cool design decisions the game makes is that, so you can buy a map for the area that fills out in like pencil form like what is around here. Then you still have to go and explore it yourself for like the map to fill in, and like there'll be maybe be specifics like some sort of iconography, or there'll be a shopkeeper or some other special thing that that is filled in by you and actually discovering that yourself. But on top of that, you only that when you discover something, like you know that it's been marked on the map. But you actually have to go to a rest stop, a checkpoint that is littered throughout the environment, sit down, and then the game pencils it in for you while you are saving. So even though you discover something, you need to then make your way to a checkpoint, and like there's a little animation where the very cute creature
takes out a pen and
takes
pad.
Out a pen, because you have to buy, there's an item called like the pencil or whatever, and like so you can't add, actually you can buy a map, but you can't inscribe new information to the map until you get a pencil, and then you can buy little badges that like let you fill in like more specifics on the map. And it's I think that little touch itself of sort of how it handles the map early on, I think illustrates sort of like the deep attention to detail in the game's mechanics, like without even having to go into all the other stuff. Like I think that little detail of like how they handle map making and map details, like I think speaks more holistically to the design framework of Hollow Knight. Like I'm really enjoying it so far.
It's funny, I hadn't made this connection before, but based on the description you just made, I'm realizing this game also feels like a sibling or a cousin to SteamWorld Dig 2, which has
great
a
game.
Right, and which also is about delving down and finding stuff and having interesting, you know, powers that let you, you know, navigate the world in new ways. But is a little more guided in that opening bit where it's like, and is a lot more like, hey, first steps, second steps. And eventually it does kind of open up to a moment where you're like, I got a lot I could go try to figure out how to do, and a lot of little challenge rooms and a lot of directions where my map is blank. But that opening, the opening salvo is like, all right, baby steps, start digging. There's a place you have to go to not too far from here. And that contrasts with the Hollow Knight version of this, which is like, yeah, okay, go down. You could go any direction you want. There's got to be stuff. Have fun. Good luck. And I think that's an interesting comparison. But also there's definitely a shared heritage there in the kind of Metroid style exploration and stuff like that. Cool. I'm excited to play it. It's on my Switch. I keep meaning to get to it and keep getting distracted because there's so much right now.
It takes about 90 minutes, and then I think you'll get a sense of like, whether it is for you. Sorry, Daniel.
Cool. No, it's cool. All I was going to say is that I played like 4 or 5 hours of it last year loved it, and we'll probably restart it on the Switch just because it's It's convenient.
It's right there. It's convenient.
I can play it on the subway.
It's such a good port. Like, it feels so natural on there that I am glad that I have waited to play it this way. I mean, I'm sad that I wasn't able to champion it, last year if it was a game that deserved something like that. But, well, now it's on Switch, which means it's a new release for me, which means I can still end up on my list at the end of the year if I end up liking it.
That's how it works. Yeah. Awesome. Rob, you wrote about a game today. That I looked at and was like, oh, that looks like a lot. But you opened this thing by saying, like, I've never lost a game. And this is Manhattan.
No, I said I had a perfect record.
That's – what's the difference?
Oh, there's a difference.
Well, I've never won a game is the thing.
I see.
I am unvictorious. I am –
there you go.
I am the Cleveland Browns. Like, we are
– oh, so come, Rob, don't be that records. Hard on yourself.
You're right. Like, ultimately, I'm about improving in this game, whereas the Cleveland Browns, like, that's not the
– you're at least acknowledging what you are and try to move forward. The Browns are the Browns.
Trust the process, Rob. You'll get there.
I was playing the Manhattan
Also,
Project.
Sorry, Dad, who is a big Cleveland Browns fan.
Oh.
But you know what it is.
Oh, wow. Anyway, how'd that end up happening?
I think I've told the story. He's from North Jersey, and he was a Jets fan as a little boy, and he saw the Jets play the Browns, and the Browns just played so hard. They didn't win that game, but they played so hard, and he was like, I'm a Browns fan now. And that
That's
was
terrible.
A long time ago, you know?
I'm so sorry, Austin's dad.
He's a loyal – I love his loyalty to the Browns more than – anything. And I love my dad a lot for a lot of reasons, but one, I love his loyalty to the Browns because he's had so many opportunities where he could have jumped ship. You know, and he'll root for the Eagles because I'm an Eagles fan, obviously, it's AFC and NFC.
He has other things going on.
Totally. But he is a Browns diehard, wears a Browns hat, has a Browns banner in his house. Aww. Like, has never, I don't know
he
if
didn't
he's
take
ever,
the Ravens off ramp.
No, that's
for that
what I'm
fandom.
Saying. He didn't take the Ravens off ramp, and then you know what happened. So, I'm sorry, Dad. Anyway, tell me more about Manhattan Project.
Yeah, so it's a worker placement board game, which, if you're not familiar with those, worker placement games tend to be about, there's different spaces on the board that let you take different actions within the context of the game, but those spaces are usually, like, once they are occupied by one player, they are occupied and other people can't use them until some kind of reset happens. So that's generally the dynamic this game follows. This is an older game. It's not a super new one at all. And I was playing the original version, not the expansion, which gets much more. It's sort of your quintessential more stuff for more stuff's sake expansion. Mm-hmm. But basically the dynamic of this game is there's the center board that everyone draws from that are like common actions, and that's where you sort of begin your turn. But then you build your own Manhattan Project, basically, your own infrastructure where you build universities, engineering facilities, that sort of thing. And then you can play any number of actions on your board, provided you've got the spaces. So it's about building, like, the most powerful arms research and manufacture engine that you can use to win the arms race.
Love how worker placement games can be about anything. You want to do like a D&D game where you put little cubes on various parts of a fantasy map? Worker placement game. You want to do a game where you're making nuclear weapons? Worker placement game. All the same. Little plastic cubes will get you anywhere.
So the thing is, I'm pretty bad at it. And there's probably some common threads to my defeats. For instance, the game is really not about launching bombing campaigns, but that is an option that you can do. You can go bomb other people's boards.
Uh-huh.
And so I do. And nobody else does, and they win. So really, it's a bad strategy. But I am like, I'm going to destroy your Manhattan Project from the air. And then while everyone else is trying to, you know, get out from under the rubble, I will win the game. I never do. And it's actually very easy to counter my bombing campaigns just by building fighters. And yet I keep trying. The other thing I tend to invest in is spies, where you get to go use other people's boards. So they build facilities, and then you just send workers over to their board. And one, you take the spot away from them. And two, you've used their space for your own ends, which is really satisfying to do. But again,
not that
probably better off building your own shit.
Just build your own shit. Just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Well,
but yeah, I can't. every time I finish this game, I always just get my ass kicked, and I'm always like, we'll get him next year. That's totally my response to this game.
Next time we need to arm up. It'll be great.
Always running an Americans campaign. That sounds that sounds about right, Rob. See you.
That's all so
right.
good. The second thing you told me about is you pitched it to me as what if Company of Heroes but Vikings? It's called Ancestors Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Not an apostrophe. I assumed it would have an apostrophe S. Like, oh, your ancestors' legacy. But no, it's it's Ancestors' Legacy. Like a Ubisoft game or something.
Holy hell. I've been mentally adding an apostrophe. Like, I just did open Steam. I was like, that can't be right.
It's extremely right.
Yeah. That is very... Yeah, okay, so Ancestors' Legacy. What kind of ancestors? We don't really know, just ancestors.
Viking ancestors, right?
They had ancestors, too.
Yeah, and so this very much is... It wears its Company of Heroes, like, DNA on its sleeve. Like, one of the key dynamics is that you can bail out of a fight with your troops and just hit the retreat button, and they will go running like hell back to base, where they can sort of replenish. I don't know. It's a cool game in a lot of ways, but I don't know if it's a very good RTS. You know what I mean? Like, as an RTS, it seems very ho-hum in a lot of ways. Like, I've yet to see anything that makes me feel like it's as good as Company of Heroes or even is nearly as ambitious. But it's kind of a cool-looking, grimdark, Viking RTS. Like, if you like burly dudes murdering each other in the driving rain with, like, spears and swords, and really well-detailed armor and shit.
I have a video up for Danielle and I to look at, and you were like, if you like burly dudes with swords and spears running through the... Like, literally the sequence on
pouring.
Our screen,
and
it's pouring rain. So you nailed it.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they lead with, and that's kind of the game.
Can you only play as Vikings, or can you also play as, like, people being raided by Vikings?
And knights. Ninjas.
That's for honor. Damn, right. You're right. Sorry. Good
so
catch.
I mostly have just been playing the first campaign, which is, like, literally off from the Viking standpoint. But there are other factions within the game. Now, I don't know how differently they're going to play. I'm really curious about that part. But, like, there's nods toward, like, more Germanic peoples.
Sure.
Anglo.
Anglo, like British.
Yeah.
Well, so I have a question.
Saxon.
There was a guy
with a scythe. Here's my question is, like, I think about Company of Heroes. For people who don't know, Company of Heroes to me felt like a complete rejuvenation of the RTS. Or I guess, like, that's that model of cover-based, like, small squad-based RTS that was not about base building as much as it was about... I mean, there was base building in it. There absolutely was. But, like, it didn't feel like I was doing micro so much as I was positioning my units tactically. Almost think of it, like, on a scale from, like, Total Annihilation or Planetary Annihilation, where there's, like, thousands and thousands or hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of units on screen, to on the other end where you're almost all the way to, like, XCOM, where it's about, I'm going to move this one unit, or Dawn of War or something, Dawn of War 2, where it's like, I'm going to move these four units or whatever. Company of Heroes had this kind of, like, tactical, slightly slower, slightly more about positioning and cover and putting people into buildings. How do you do that in a game where you have axes and swords? Or is there some other comparison you want to make between the two?
No, that's not a bad one. The way you do it is flanking bonuses, charge bonuses matter a lot. So, like, there's a lot of order of operations just in managing an engagement. So, like, you'll want your shield wall troops to just stand and absorb a charge.
Right.
And then you want to make sure your other troops, like, loop around to the side or the back and hit there, because they're going to get damage bonuses and, like, maybe cause the enemy to rout.
Gotcha.
The other thing that they've done is there are some just really punishing decisions in this game. Your archers, if they're positioned, like, behind your troops and are firing into a melee, are going to hit your soldiers.
Oh, wow.
So you need to micro your archers like crazy to make sure they have a clear-ish line of fire so they're not just, like, plinking your guys in the back of the head while they're fighting some Saxons.
Great.
So that's kind of how they do it, is there's some unforgiving touches here.
Cool. I'm curious, did that just come out on Steam?
It's
like a month ago.
From before E3. Okay. It was one of those, like, you know, it was late spring releases, and then...
So
and
it goes. Then, like, yeah. I have one thing to hit real briefly, and I'm upset that it's really briefly, because if I liked it a lot, this would be a whole segment, and instead it's going to be me going, like...
You're gonna hit it briefly? Is
that... Don't... No, that's new games. We talked about Mario Tennis last time. We'll talk about Mario Tennis. Sorry.
Sure.
So peek back the curtain. I was like, we'll talk about all the new games we played first, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and catch up on games we played last week and talked about. But New Gundam Breaker. The name of the game is New
Sounds
Gundam
great.
Breaker. Gundam Breaker 3 was really... Okay, let me just really high level...
You make Gundams and you break them in half.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is a Gundam model based. All right, so in the world of Gundam TV shows, there are a bunch of different like sub-universes and blah blah blah. One of them, two of them actually, exist in a world in which you have like Pokemon style fights with with model Gundams.
Okay.
You build your model Gundam and you take it to like a Gundam center and you fight with it. And it's kids.
That's really good.
It's really
cool.
Good. Like it's genuinely
That's
fucking
a great
cool.
Premise.
It's a fantastic premise because
are there toy tie-ins by chance?
I mean, there are. Regular Gundam already has toys. This is like closes the loop, right? Like Gundam as a show, historically, one of the reasons it's been successful, one of the reasons it touched anime so deeply is it was a great vehicle for toys. And specifically for Gunpla, which are Gundam plastic models. Pla
oh, that's
is
what
plastic.
That means.
And
I thought that was a corruption of Gunplay.
No, it was not. It's Pla as in Pla, plastic, plastic. I get it. So, Pla, says Natalie off mic. In the Gundam Breaker games, they exist in a universe sort of like it's a different one again, the TV shows where there are kids who build Gundam models and then fight with them, and you get to do it. You get to like bash together all the different Gundam kits, and you're like, oh, I really want to take Gundam Wings, cool, like green torso like gem thing and put that on the Goof Customs at what I mean, like
and
all
make
the
him
different
kiss.
And make him well, no
yeah,
there's no
kiss.
Kiss well so the new one has kissing in maybe a different way which I'll get to. The thing is, they turn into action games, which are something between in play. Again, I'm going to do this like scale. On one hand, you have something like Gundam Versus, which is this like, or Virtual On, which is this like very intense fighting game where you care a lot about trajectory and boosts and like what your boost gauge is at and like making sure that you have enough energy to do cool attacks and it's like a fighting game, like, you know, dash canceling and stuff. And on the other end, you have something like Dynasty Warriors Gundam, which is I'm square, 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 triangle, triangle, square, triangle, triangle. And I'm just killing thousands of enemies. And Gundam Breaker games have been kind of right in the middle. They feel like beat 'em ups. You build a cool mech, you then fight a bunch of things in your cool mech, and they're kind of fan service-y in that sense. This one is made by a new developer. It has new in the front, the way that certain, you know, in Japan sometimes a game will be recreated and they'll be like, oh, this isn't Dynasty Warriors, this is Shin Dynasty
it's
Warriors.
Not your dad's
this is
Dynasty
new
Warriors.
This is not right, this is new Dynasty Warriors. Oh, this is new Gundam Breaker. And it sucks. It's so bad.
Aww.
It's like janky in ways that like I haven't seen in a major AAA game release in a long time, to where like you don't have to have seen a lot of giant robot anime to know that a thing that happens in giant robot anime is that a mech launches from like a launch pad, and it's like it'll be like, you know, Austin launching or whatever, and then the mech launches. In this, before every mission, it does that, except it's a camera shot of like where your mech is supposed to be, and sometimes it's not loaded in yet. And I don't mean, to be clear, I don't mean that it hasn't shown up visually in the sense that, like, it's there, but the texture hasn't popped in. I mean, it exists in the game world, and it hasn't yet been moved into where the launch pad is. So sometimes you see the game, like, oh, shit, the Gundam's supposed to be over here. And it's like, yanks it from off screen, and you can just see the legs, like, fall into place. And the camera moves in a bad way. Like, the presentation level is just completely trash. The sound dips out sometimes. As just like a piece of software, I've had 5 or 6 second freezes in the middle of combat. Not stutters, not frame rate dips, just like, oh, it's frozen for 5 seconds. Cool. And the combat feels so bad because it's the biggest thing for me is they two big things. One, they got rid of the dash canceling, which in a game like this, or think about like a game like Devil May Cry or Bayonetta, if you want, where like you're doing a combo and then you can dodge roll out of the combo. In this, it's like you're doing your ba ba ba, and they're like, oh shit, something's coming in, and you want to hit the dash button to do a cool boost dash to the side. You can't. You're just in your attack. So it's almost more like something like the Soul style of really, you know, discrete attack animations, very, very not precise either. It's just clunky, and but at the same time, the fights are not like one-on-one duels. They're these like 30 or 40 characters on screen, which is more than the system can handle. It's terrible. It's so bad.
We need a new.
It sounds like it's killing you.
It is killing me.
Oh.
And here's why. Because the story setup's really good. You're the new kid. You've shown up to the Gundam Academy, like the Gundam Model Academy school.
Wait. So it's a school for making the models, not for being a pilot?
Not being a pilot, because it's our world. It's Earth. There are no mechs, right?
Okay.
It's
yet.
Yet. Exactly. Well, that might come up. We could see. Who could say? And the story genuinely is, years ago, everything was cool at Gundam Academy, whatever the name of the actual place is. I forget the actual name that they call it. But and then there was a coup among the student council, and there had been a really egalitarian student council, and everything was about the joy of and the camaraderie of building together. But the new kids came and they overthrew the school council, and they defeated them in a fight, and no one trusted the old school council. So then there was an election, and the new school council, who were a bunch of fucking egotistical, like
gatekeepers,
not just gatekeepers, more than that, because it turns out
Gundam keepers.
What they said was, here's what they said. They were like, we need the purity of combat and people who work for it, those are the people who should be rewarded, not just people who are creative, not your elites, not just – and so they swept into power, and it turns out actually they are like the children of real-life powerful political figures. They have all these connections throughout the school with all the different cliques and have built like this terrible swampy political like
– Swampy,
you say. I'm just throwing words out there right now.
So it's a neoliberal meritocracy of like
– Right.
So revolution. Like,
they add a ranking system. There previously hadn't been a ranking system, and now you get ranked as how good of a combat pilot you are. And if you're low, you have to listen to what anybody above you says. And
use all your meow beans.
It's all 100%. And of course, on top of this, all of this is delivered as a visual novel that has three different routes tied to three different girls who are in the Gundam Club with you. And like one of them is tsundere and just like really is like she's really like not like kind and quiet until she's in a match, at which point she's like, I'm going to fucking tear their heads off. They don't know what they're going to get. And she's amazing. There's like a ditzy one who falls asleep inside of the Gundam like VR cockpit. Then there's like the girl next door. They're all great. And I love that bullshit. I love this like Gundam high school bullshit. So much. The game itself is such trash besides the visual novel part, and it breaks my heart.
So what I'm hearing here is that you're actually going to force yourself to play
through this piece of shit. I'm not. I'm really not.
My other
not.
Question, having heard that,
yeah.
What if it were patched? Could it become good? It could somebody patched a lot of that, like the delays, the missed animation cues.
But what if they know Gundam fans will buy this anyway, and they'll just make a sequel?
This is the thing that is actually genuinely upsetting for me is in the era of the PS2, they released a bunch. Bandai Namco released a bunch of Gundam games of mixed quality, but they were doing really cool experimental stuff, ranging from the fighting game style stuff like Gundam Versus to things that were like almost tactical action games. There was a PS2 game called Xeonic Front, and Xeon is one of the major factions in the world of Gundam. And Xeonic Front was like, what if Rainbow Six but mechs? Like, you plotted out your Rainbow Six style, like, or OG PC Rainbow Six. You plotted out your attack for
me. Rob is very excited.
Rob is bouncing up and down. And you were playing as, like, the bad guys. You were playing, like, as basically the Rommel part. Like, oh, they're really bad, but you're playing, like, the part of them, like, you know, they're just focused on being good soldiers. You know, they don't have the bad politics associated with them. They're kind of noble. And so, like, for me, that was a great age. They were just tossing Gundam games out, but none of them fucking sold. And so when the PS3 era hit, they released Gundam Crossfire, which was trash, and then they never localized a single Gundam game besides the Dynasty Warrior ones for years across the PS3 and the Xbox 360. The last year is the first time they've started bringing Gundam games back out. So yes, Patrick, people like me are going to buy this game to support Gundam.
Uh-huh, yeah.
To try to encourage them to keep bringing these games out. And it sucks. And we shouldn't do it. Don't buy this game. If you like Gundam games, go import the Malaysian version of Gundam Breaker 3 because that's in English fully, 100%, and it was better than this is. Sorry. That was supposed to be short. We should take a break. I'm going to link you to some videos of Zeotic Front, Rob. We'll be right back.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And we are back with we talked about the new games we played. Let's talk about a little bit, at least, about some of the ones we touched back on. This is actually going to be brief. We had a great stream this morning in which we played some Mario Tennis Aces. It was me and Natalie Watson and Joel Fowler, Waypoint's publisher, and also Ricardo Cotto, who has joined us as a social editor, taking up Danica's sword and stepping into her shoes, at least for the next month or so. It's kind of a fluctuating position. We'll see how things go with Cotto. I have nothing but faith that Cotto will do great.
It's more whether the company lets us hire a person. That's the...
Oh, it's like a bunch of things. It's like, yeah, it's that, but things. It's also, it's a
what's
bunch
of position as we look like.
What is our structure?
Like, yeah, that's
we're
all
making some
here.
Big moves. We're making some big pitches in the near future in terms of like shape and structure. And so a lot of that could change things a bunch of different ways. So, but very thankful for Cotto, and Cotto is very good at that game. But I think at the end of the day, it's fair to say Natalie and I stepped away champions, duo champions.
Huh.
That'll be going up on the YouTube. All right,
so
probably
you'd say
tomorrow.
You're aces. We're aces. Tennis aces?
Yeah, good. We're tennis aces. It was. I think that game in multiplayer is really good. So last week I'd kind of said like, I'm not really sure the single player has enough. I wish there was some more tutorialization. And I had the review written, like 100% had it written, like down to 90% of it or something. I was like, I need like three more paragraphs or something. And then the servers came online and I finally got to play that game multiplayer. It's really good. It's like... I just, you know, you can go back to last week to hear my basic pitch on it in terms of like the fighting game stuff, in terms of like it having energy bars and stuff like that. I will say, Patrick, you had some reservations. You were like, I really wanted like Wii tennis, but more. And we played simple mode today at length, which gets rid of some of like the special bars and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you might really like that mode. It is competitively so good. Getting the rallies up, getting to like have these like back and forth battles, starting to read your opponent a little bit in terms of like where they're going to place the ball, or are they going to try to drop shot it so it just lands right in front of the net and like get to rush up and grab it. That stuff is so fun and so rewarding and just feels so crisp. You know, I'd say like there are a couple of times in the last week that, where I've been like, I thought I should have hit that ball, but I didn't. But beyond that, like it has been such a good time that I have like – ended up recommending it way harder than I thought I would. I thought I'd be like, the basics feel good, but there's just not enough meat on this bone or whatever. Video games dot internet.
Review.
7.5
but
out
it
of
does,
10.
It does seem like it's like pretty contingent on you being interested in playing.
Seven yahoos out of 10 or whatever.
Okay.
There it is. Yeah, that's it.
It was just okay.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So what you just said is true, which is like you need to want to be able to play multiplayer here. You need to want to play multiplayer. If you don't want to play multiplayer with this game, probably not for you. Unfortunately, yeah. I really wanted it to be that old Camelot style of single player RPG where you're leveling up and making choices about what stats you're getting and like or like Golf Story, but tennis would have been dope. But it's not that. I still think it's worth playing. Because it just feels so good, and I even though I'm not a big multiplayer person, like not only am I not a big multiplayer person, I'm really not a big like sit around a couch play with my friends multiplayer person at this point in my life. And we did it this morning, and I had a great time. So,
yeah,
Well, they've also gotten away from, as I understand it, it's not like an ELO system they're using for matchmaking. You're sort of always being put into virtual tournaments, right? So, like, I think one thing that always puts people, certainly puts me off a lot of multiplayer systems is that you get in that multiplayer grind where it's like the system is designed to, over time, match you with people where you'll win 50% of the time and lose 50% of the time. Yeah. Otherwise, you're not properly matched. But the problem with that is, that feels shitty.
Yeah.
Because that, like, one, going one for one still doesn't feel great. It's tough to feel like you're improving. But two, that doesn't rule out the fact that you'll have these streaks where you just get, like, fucking stomped three times in a row in your host. I think Tennis Aces is doing sort of a make-believe bracket system where you're being matched with people who are on simple, like, winning streaks.
So what it seems like. Yeah, so it's like if you enter a tournament mode and you haven't played or you're coming off of another tournament mode, like, set, you go against someone who's at 0-0 in the tournament, who has no wins yet, no losses. I mean, once you lose, you're out of the tournament. You have to start over. But it's a faux tournament, right? Like, it's just pulling from all the players, right? And so if you win, you advance to play against someone who has beaten one other opponent. And if you win again, you advance to play someone who's defeated two other opponents. And that only happens four times, I think. I think if you go 4-0 or if you go 5-0, I think you win that tournament. You get a bunch of points added to your ranking, and then you start over. Now, what I don't know is it adding those points to your ranking, is it also trying to match you based on points? I have no idea. Like, if I end up with like 10,000 points or something, is it going to try to match me in round one against other people who have between 8,000 and 12,000 points? Like, I honestly don't know. And if it is doing that, it has not communicated that at all. I'm just shocked that the moment-to-moment stuff feels as good as it does, which maybe I shouldn't be. It's Nintendo. Nintendo, like, really – and it's Camelot, and those are two, you know, groups that really do prize game feel quite a bit. But you know, still really great.
Nice.
We'll see. We'll see, like, if it has a tail. I'm curious a month from now where it's at. I'd like to see some more support for competitive stuff and for casual stuff too. Who else? Who has something else that they want to check in on that they've been playing over the last couple weeks?
People should play Vampire.
Did you beat it?
Need to.
I don't have a lot to say about it. If you are bored with video games right now and you want to take a risk on something that's a little bit frustrating, a little bit strange, and you'll constantly be going, I wish they made a slightly better version of this, but probably that better version couldn't exist, and so you should just, like, be happy with, like, the
this
weird
the
thing
pitch?
That it is. Yeah.
It's honesty. Like, who says there can't be honesty in sales?
it's not a sales pitch as much as, like, it's a weird game that I wonder if everyone else has had games that you find yourself just, like, drawn to, and yet if you were to put down a bullet point list of, like, the good and the bad, you'd be like, this game is probably not great, but man, like, the things that it has and are just, like, so – I found myself so drawn to it. It's a frustrating game to play. I hate running all over the map. There's no fast travel for no good reason. Most of the game is about interacting with NPCs, but they don't let you mark those NPCs on the map, and they just go to random locations, so you just wander around hoping you'll run into them. Like, the game's 30-hour length is probably, like, 11 hours inflated because of a lot of this bullshit. And yet, like, the interaction between characters, like the character you play, the main storyline, the way – different sort of, like, modern sort of political threads are woven in, like, this weird era that you're running around with. It's just the parts that I like about Life is Strange, like, interesting characters that are, like, played very earnest. Like, that part carries over here. The tone is, like, completely different. But it has that part of what it is maybe is becoming part of, like, a sort of, like, a collective DNA thread for Don't Nod and the kind of stories they want to tell. And yeah, if I just recommend some people to – maybe not a game to pay full price for, but it's a game that
sure.
I have find, like, very – I'm just fascinated by it. It's what I keep coming back to. Like, the moment I have free time, like, my kid's taking a nap, I should probably go pull weeds out in my backyard. That shit adds
instead.
Up.
Instead.
But you know what? Like, what if I go and investigate this bomb site in Vampire and see where that quest leads? It was not satisfying. It wasn't particularly good.
There were just dead squirrels. Quest,
but
yeah.
Other ones, yeah. Well, they would have been blown to pieces.
Yeah.
But,
God.
It is the definition of a game that, like, reviews poorly, probably, but it just has something that I think more people than they would assume would find something in it to really right. enjoy. And so I'm like 20 hours in and probably have like another 5 to 6 to go and have really, really enjoyed my time with it. I'm hoping to find I'm gonna play the Life is Strange and then hopefully have time to finally sit down and kind of put into more articulate words like
why this is working for me.
But I definitely would recommend it to folks if you're just looking for something different. Right. Like Vampire is like absolutely something to take a chance on.
Cool. Danielle, you've been continuing to play some Onrush?
Yeah, I'll check in briefly with that. I'm writing a tiny thing for tomorrow about Onrush. But, you know, the pitch being it's a racing game where just getting from point A to point B fast is not really your goal. You're on a big level with a big team, and you're scoring points in different ways. You might be like a support class. You might be somebody who needs to do tricks. That's how you're scoring points. Yeah. And it's almost a little bit more Splatoon structure than mechanically like Splatoon, but in terms of there's two teams and you're both buying for points, basically.
Right. There's no painting. That'd be cool.
No, I don't think there's any painting.
It'd be cool if you like a game type where the goal is to paint the entire track.
That would be rad as hell.
That'd be cool.
I mean, we gotta, you know, call in. We'll just, call hey, guys.
Onrush.
Hey, folks.
What are you fighting on?
It's Codemasters. PS4.
Okay.
But briefly, I think one of the other reasons, other than this is like fresh and it feels really good to drive around and be fast, is that it actually mirrors cross country in a weird way. I was like the captain of my college cross country team. Right. I was like the little cross country queen. And what people don't know about cross country is that it's not just running fast. There's actually strategy, and cross country courses are like obstacle courses. They're usually in the woods. There's hills. There's rocks. There's streams you have to cross, things like that. So this weirdly feels like, and you're on a team with other people, and everybody scores points. Obviously, in cross country, you're not like smacking your teammate.
You can just like elbow somebody.
I mean, that happens. Don't get me wrong, that happens. That's not part of the sport, but that happens. They're throwing some bows.
Damn,
you know,
really?
In the day, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, there were always like be like that one girl you knew. She had the hot pink shoes, and like she fights dirty.
Damn.
Yeah. It's funny. Okay. But anyway, like, it feels a little bit like that. Like, you're on a team. You're all sort of individually going for your own race or, you know, in this context, for the tricks or whatever it is. But you're all on a team and scoring points for that. So it's this weird and kind of awesome divide of, like, the team versus the individual performance that I find really satisfying.
Awesome.
Also, it feels good to go fast.
Yeah, that game is so high on my I want to play this game list.
It's really fun.
And also, I wish it was on PC.
I know
it's coming on PC, and so I just keep like going to buy it. But it's like a $60 game.
Yeah.
It's not like a no dollar game. It ain't cheap.
Oh, no dollar game.
It's not. Okay, what I mean is, it's not this year's Rocket League. It's not a PS Plus game, and it's not a $20 game. It's not a $30. It's a $60 game.
It's a $60 game.
And I keep worrying that I'm going to buy it and then try to find a match and not find one. But it sounds
the community's healthy. I'm having no problem.
Okay.
I mean, on PS4 again. You know.
I just don't want to buy it twice. I should just buy it.
Just, I mean, having a really good time with it, so
right.
It gets
so
my recommendation.
Cool,
personally, and I'm also playing more Prey.
Mooncrash
is really good.
I heard you met yourself in that game.
I met myself. I met Dr. Deanna Riendo, who's like a character in the game. I thought it was just like, oh, that's cute. There's like
someone
body
sent it to you and said like, oh, look, your name comes up. Riendo comes up,
right? But there's like emails. There's like a character. She's like an evil scientist. It was weird.
That's
it's a little weird, but awesome.
Congratulations!
Yeah, you know, I've made it.
You made
in
it
life
to Prey. You live in Prey.
I live in Prey. Okay. I got killed by a siphon in Prey. Yes, Rob.
No, I mean, it doesn't sound like you live in Prey, right?
Right.
Like, yeah.
I don't think I'm alive.
If you have to die, Steve, to die somewhere one day. Why not on the moon?
Why not on the moon? Exactly. Playing lunar basketball. It's awesome. I'm really loving it. It's really hard. That's the other thing.
Oh, really? Did you hit the
point?
Because when we talked last week, I don't want to say that like you were having an easy time of it, but it didn't sound like you'd hit the run-based stuff that much.
Yeah, I've gotten to there.
So wait, talk to me about the structure. Because like, that was some stuff that we didn't really know was like, well, do you have to go back to being the first character over and over again?
Yeah, if you keep dying.
Okay.
You do.
But if you advance, so it is a thing where it's like,
if you advance, it means you have to unlock, not only unlock those characters, but beat it with those characters in order to get the full, you know, to beat it, quote unquote. I have not beaten it yet. I have not.
How many characters have you escaped with?
Just a couple still. Because what I'm doing is I'm working on their special quests as opposed to just kind of like focusing on, all right, beat it with them. Now we unlock a new one. Instead, I'm like, no, the story stuff is what's okay. Again. Yeah. I love the story stuff.
No, it's good to hear that stuff is
so
there.
So I'm going really, really in deep for their, like, story quests, so which are harder quests, than just escaping.
Are the story quests, do they change from run to run?
Or they change from character to character.
Right.
So the, like, general quest is always escape.
Right, right, right.
But each character has their own story. They have a special story quest within the world. And that is the same from run to run.
Right, but
you have to find this person, you have to find what happened to them, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I guess my question is, like, you have that Russian prisoner character.
Yes.
Have you completed his story?
No, because I'm working on the engineer's story.
Okay, so
more intensely.
Sorry, I guess the thing that I'm trying to figure out is, let's say you complete their story.
Mm-hmm.
Have you completed anybody's side story? Okay.
I'm working on it.
The thing I want to know is, like, if you complete their story stuff, does that mean that the next time you die and play as them, do you still have to do that story stuff again? Or is it cleared and you get some sort of bonus for when you're playing as them to escape?
I mean, you get points for basically everything that you do, so I'm sure you get the points
right.
for that.
I just want to know if, like, when you die and you start over, does it say, and now here's the story mission, like, Russian prisoner, engineer quest, personal story quest, does it pop back up? Once you, I'm just curious.
I'm not sure, but I think you can ignore that stuff if you wanted to,
right,
certainly.
Right,
but
right.
I think it's like the meat of
totally
of part of the game. I know I'm going to go back and keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it because that's the kind of person I am because I like those mechanics a lot. And I'm really, really diving into some of the new weapons and sort of the new ways of playing and really having fun with the
what
engineer.
What is your favorite new like tool or weapon?
There's a glue turret.
Oh,
it's awesome.
How's that work?
It just glues the shit out of everything.
Okay, so it's just doing the, like, combat glue. It's not, like, building...
No, I mean, it's building stuff, too. So you can, like, use it to kill an enemy and then climb up all the stuff
that
you
need.
Oh,
okay, cool.
So it's,
that's awesome.
Like, really fun.
Nice.
It's good shit. Anyway, Pre-Moon Crash is awesome.
It is also still on my list of things. Is that it sounds like a version of that game that I would like a lot, given the stuff. How many zero-G segments are there?
None so far, but there are lunar gravity.
Oh, so they did
segments.
Do the lunar gravity.
Yeah, they
thing
did. They
about.
Super did.
Good.
There are areas where you enter normal gravity in like indoor areas,
right.
even though you're always on the moon. They don't quite explain this, but whatever, it's fine. And then there's like when you're in the dome, but you can see the Earth and you can see the lunar soil. Those are lunar gravity.
You know, maybe one day there'll be a moment where they show like.
I think there's a log in the first game that says how they make the fake gravity. It's not just a spin thing.
That's
anyway.
Gotta be it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Austin, your list is long.
This is it. I think that's it.
At right now.
What?
No, I mean the games that you say you want to play.
Yeah, Doc. It's not like I don't want to talk about my life. Rob,
well,
you're playing The Division.
Okay. Mm.
See? Yeah. See how much easier it is than talking about my life? Is like, hey, Rob's playing The Division.
Yes.
That's so much easier than
okay.
I don't have any free time.
Another pod.
Yeah.
Yeah. Austin's I'm playing life. The Division. You know, in these troubled times, I was like, I need some apolitical fun. And so I just got locked and loaded and tooled up on the streets of New York, where, you know, just various forms of evildoers and ne'er-do-wells.
As it were.
Are up to some kind of meaningless activity that is just not good for the people of New York.
Right.
And obviously, of course... You know, the people you're fighting are not the people of New York. Anyway, point is, don't worry about it. It's all good. But anyway.
Check out this gun. That's the point is, you see this cool gun I got?
Left trigger, right trigger. Left trigger, right trigger.
Yeah. Politics is easy.
Trigger those
Try lids. To be in the center, left trigger and right trigger. You know?
We hold them at the same time. What
I don't know. Special abilities, probably.
Civilities.
So I wear... You know, I declare my allegiances on my sleeve in The Division, and my allegiances are to functional, slightly form-fitting, but utilitarian urban chic.
Okay.
So that's kind of my aesthetic, and those are going to be my politics in the world of The Division as well. No, but actually, so I've ended up kind of trapped in The Division, like literally trapped in the safe house, which is kind of ironic because you're not supposed safe houses are supposed to be hub zones
right.
that you kind of go to and like leave from and go have adventures from. But I wandered into Times Square.
That's a cool late
house.
Game area. So
yeah, and it is cool. But the problem is if you exit the safe house at the end of each end of the block. So if you go north. Out of the safe house, you'll run to one group of enemies that has like a group of elite enemies led by a named enemy.
Yeah.
And if you go south, you run into a similar group.
Yeah.
Each of which are a little too strong for me to take on by myself, but I hate playing with people.
Gotcha.
So I'm kind of soloing the division. Well, I like playing with people, but sometimes it can be aggravating.
Yeah.
And so I'm just mostly doing the quests. The trouble is, I can't get out of this goddamn safe house because I keep wandering into gun battles with these like, no matter which direction I go, I'm probably going to pull aggro from one of these two, like, patrols. And they are just, they are so tantalizingly within reach of right. me being able to solo them, but not quite.
Yeah.
And so I just keep chain dying and running back inside, respawning in the safe house. And I'm like, this time,
this is
I'm not going to play like an asshole. I'm going to, you know, see,
save my consumables. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, this time I'm gonna figure it out. This time I'm gonna be conservative. I'm gonna make full use of cover. I'm gonna use suppression. Gonna use all my explosives. It's gonna be great. And I get these guys. The boss enemy in particular is the one that usually does it. I get them so close, and then they just sort of bull rush me, and I break cover and just get gunned down like Butch Cassidy in Sundance. Spoiler.
That's a big spoiler. No. That's the end of the division, actually, is they just, you go and do Madison Square Garden, and everyone just watches Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's great. It's really, everyone's happy again.
Sounds nice.
Building on that, we have a question in the question bucket that I think is worth hitting before we wrap up. If you have a question, you can send it to gaming@vice.com. This one comes in from Jupiter Doomsday.
Oh.
Which, what a fucking good name.
Good name.
What a good name, Jupiter Doomsday. They write, co-writer and animator of Indie Darling Night in the Woods, had a GDC talk this year called Let's Nuke Possum Springs, and there's a segment about the importance of political directness, quote-unquote, in video game narratives. Basically, he mentions how AAA video games will tend to take the icons slash images slash logos of a movement or a time period, but will never tackle the politics that come from that aesthetic or era, and don't apply it to anything meaningful into the game's narrative. Scott Benson, who's the person who's talking, then proceeded to criticize this tactic as a form of tourism. This had me thinking about the recent, quote, mature AAA games these past years, such as Bioshock Infinite, Deus Ex Mankind Divided, Ogg's Lives Matter, Far Cry 5, Detroit Become Human, and Polygon's recent interview with the Division 2's creative designer, denying that their game has anything political to say as the prime examples of this. So my question is, how do you feel about this? I'm curious about what your thoughts are on this lack of political directness, quote-unquote, in the games industry, and whether or not it amounts to anything harmful or might actually impede on the game industry itself. I think there should probably be an added bit here, which is that Yves Guillemot, the CEO of Ubi, CEO, had there was an interview that ran in The Guardian today. Keith Stort ran it. That was basically Eve saying, I'm going to just read this quote directly. Quote, our goal in all the games we create is to make people think. We want to put them in front of questions that they don't always ask themselves automatically. We want players to listen to different opinions and to have their own opinions. Our goal is to give all the tools to the player in order for them to think about the subjects, to be able to see things from far away, from far enough away. And then Keith adds, in effect, then, Ubisoft sees itself as making games that have political themes but are also politically impartial? Question. And Yves responds, that's right. So the player is part of, you speak with people who have different opinion from your own, you test different things so you can improve your vision of that subject. That's what we want to do. We don't want to say, do that, think like this. Our goal is to make sure after playing, you're more aware. And like,
I didn't know the woke gamer was doing interviews.
Woke gamer is there. The woke gamer is it. And Guillemot goes on to basically say that, like, well, you can't have a distinct, these are simulations. These aren't statements because you have a player. And when you have a player, you know, the player is the person who's going to make decisions. It's our job. This is a quote. It's our job to make sure you feel free to go one way or the other, to make actions and to experience the consequences, which is bullshit if you play Ubisoft games, mm-hmm. because they often do not let you take choices about how to tackle this stuff. Like, it is not that particular line of argument. Like, here's the thing that's
I'll say it's a better answer.
I think the beginning of this is a better answer. I think the beginning of this...
No. Yeah. Hold on. Don't... When I'm saying a better answer, I'm not saying it's a good answer or a satisfying answer. I'm saying he has thought about this question being asked and has a response
that
formulated.
That is not just...
That at least... That feels as though, like, oh, shit, like, someone's going to ask about politics. Like, because in... It's an answer, as opposed to our games are apolitical. Wait. There's no politics in the American flag. That's not an answer.
I want to make sure we're painting something right here, though, because he also says this. The long-term goal is, why not simulate other ways to live and to work and behave together in video games so that people can experiment with them to see if it works or not? It's the same with technology. The goal is to test new things because as tech is changing, video games can have a chance to experiment with what will happen in the future. You'll be able to see it in a video game so you're aware of what may happen. Which is just – he is just stumbling forward at that point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. I think the very beginning of this is thought out even if I disagree with it, right? I do think
right.
I think it is, and also he's a CEO, right? But like there's a version of what he starts with here, which is we want to ask questions to our players that we hear in film and in literature and in TV all the time. You talk to the
and take advantage of the unique interactivity of video games, which allow you to like explore your own,
which
like,
is still a shitty
meaning.
Answer. But it only gets worse and worse as he goes on because you then. Get to think about what Ubisoft's games are, and they don't do this. And that's part of the major problem.
No, they're like they're just introducing now the idea that like pick who you want to have sex with. So like don't act like
you're on
these
the
games
edge.
Have like profound like ethical and moral like choices that like give you agency over the story.
Yeah.
And because that's Watch Dogs in particular, like the most political of their frame. I mean, maybe the most explicitly.
Watch Dogs 2, certainly,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, but yes, like, I mean, you know, it's not a, like a long lineage in their games where it's like, where they explore that specific thing that he's touching on.
What do people think about this notion of political directness, though? This idea of like, hey, don't just lift the iconography of a social movement or a political movement. Like, engage with the issues. Try to have a story that has some thematic through line that is aware of that history and maybe saying something of value. Danielle's nodding. Yeah.
It just has always struck me as being very immature and cowardly, frankly, to kind of use the window dressing without ever actually taking a stand or feeling as if it was actually making some sort of value judgment of, hey, some things are better than other things. Some things are worse than other things. And it's good and okay to take a stand on that and draw a line in the sand and say something about those things.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I know there's a huge thing with marketing versus what's the content of the actual game. So
sure.
The whole Augs Lives Matter thing was really rough, obviously, because of what it was appropriating. And as I understand it, I didn't play that game. That's the thing I always have to sort of say. But as I understand it, the game didn't necessarily waffle as poorly as that marketing did. But that marketing definitely like told me something about how they thought they were positioning this game and how they were stumbling with something important and that you shouldn't stumble with, basically.
Right.
I'm trying to think of good examples of games in the mainstream space that have done something useful with this that have had Mafia 3 to some extent had at least some mechanics that said something interesting.
Totally.
With regard to the neighborhoods you could be in and how fast the cops would be called.
Totally.
Basically.
And like actually seemed like where they were using those that iconography and that language and like a shared history of symbols felt like it was being used to evoke that thing. It was not kind of decontextualized and then recontextualized, like reterritorialized into a position separate from politics, which is what happens again and again and again, right?
And Far Cry 5 is obviously a pretty,
pretty
easy one to draw from. There's a really great, I'll just shout this out, really great Campster video about Far Cry 5 and how hard it tries to not say anything whatsoever. And that's it's just like, watch that video. Like, it's just a really good deconstruction of a lot of the symbols that they use, a lot of the cult stuff, a lot of the sort of Tea Party stuff that they use. And how far they go to not say anything with it is like instructive and fascinating. So,
well, like, and I think that there is also something here, which is a layer under that to think about the Guillemot response to this stuff, which is like, well, we need players to have agency and to be able to choose, and we're just kind of putting out a buffet of political positions. Is like shrugging. It's this sort of like disavowal of responsibility, or disavowal of curatorial or creative like power. You think about something like Far Cry 5. There are a lot of decisions went into making those characters and making the filling that game with you know different NPCs who said specific lines of dialogue that gave you specific quests. The same thing is true for Watch Dogs 2, which, barring some serious problems, I actually think does a really good job of having, whether or not I agree with it, a pretty clear political through line, or not even just political, but social, thematic, deep, big picture ideas about authority and about freedom and about youth and like all of these things that if you played that game, you'd come away with it thinking about specific things and having well-crafted perspectives on that thing. I don't think it's a perfect game by any means, but like you can point to it and say, oh, here's the stuff that's at the heart of it. And it's so hard for me. Even something like The Division is clearly – there are through lines about authority, about a crisis, about response, like the American response to things. Like that stuff is all in there, and it's so frustrating to have the waffling. Not because what I think any of us want is like, tell us your games hate Trump. Like that's a real – that would actually be infuriating also, is like if The Division 2 I'd be so taken by the directness that I'd be like, yo, wow, I can't believe that
– never seen this before.
Yves Guillemot came out and was like, fuck Donald Trump and we wanted to be clear. That would be
– Well, I mean like Far Cry 5, like right. You know, it invokes like the quest for the Trump
right.
tape, which
right.
our own company made you know, but that quest falls completely flat. Like, it's not funny or interesting, partially because it, like, actually refuses to engage with, like, the joke it's
right.
making. And it's not a particularly well-written joke. But even in the instances where it says, like, all right, motherfuckers, like, we're not just going to wink. We're going to, like, wink with both eyes
double
at
wink.
What's going on. But it doesn't actually – it waffles in the process of even, like, going that far. Danielle, you were looking for games that, you know, try to do this. I think Mafia 3 was a good example. But then the counterexample to that, the opposite of that, is like Bethesda's Fallout right. games,
yes.
right? Like, which are like, entirely, but largely, like, ape a certain aesthetic from American culture without actually engaging with, like, what it means to, like, have a game that doesn't just use that as aesthetics, but in, like, a lot of ways, like, looks as that as some sort of, like, platonic, holistic
right.
ideal that is aspirational. And if you're going to do that, then at least there should be some sort of conversation about, like, what's wrong with that? Like, that being the ideal. And, I am sure there are quests that do deal with that. And, like I can't remember my entire, like, hundreds of hours in Fallout, Fallout New Vegas, and Fallout 4. But, like, I would say, like a big picture, that's not necessarily what the Fallout games are doing, even if they do it at the margins within some
right.
quests. Like, the games often feel as though they are taking a certain aesthetic without actually engaging with the consequences of the aesthetic and its time period.
I think that, one, you could say the Fallout 1 and 2 absolutely engage with that stuff.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying.
And then, right, totally. But then I think with 4, a game that I think I like more than most people, I think it really materializes that, like literally reifies it in the design of the game, because the core new addition is you can transform the world to be beautiful again. You can make it the 1950s like kind of nostalgia, retrofuturism that the world was before the bombs dropped and ruined everything. And yes, I actually do think that if you start digging through computers, you will still see the good writing of those teams. That's like, oh, well, here's how this corporation was an arms manufacturer and blah, blah, blah. So it does touch that stuff.
The Fallout games are political.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
In no way am I going to say like they do not like engage with like political ideas or take positions. And like
but they increasingly have under Bethesda's reign, under Bethesda's output
tutelage.
Under Bethesda's tutelage, they've increasingly moved away from using that aesthetic as a critical aesthetic and moving towards it as like celebrationist. Rob, you look like you had some deep Fallout thoughts.
No, I mean, it was basically to the point of, like, under Bethesda, they've certainly the aesthetic has gone from being an ironic counterpoint to the message of the stories to being a brand in ways that I think are dangerous. Like, the opening shot of Fallout is of a summary execution, with American boys waving to the camera as they murder someone. And the entire, like, backdrop of that universe is like, you know, these people were all basically fucking Nazis, right? Like, that's kind of the backdrop here. Is that, like, it's an America where, you know, civil rights movements, leftism, New Deal, like, none of that ever happens, really. And it just, like, goes all the way down to, you know, new, like, unhinged nuclear age nihilism. No, I've been losing my mind trying to find a review of The Dark Knight Rises that I thought was by a Jacobin mag, but it doesn't seem to be. But basically, it was a review arguing that Nolan's picture was, like, in love with the spectacle of class uprising, and like, and literally, like, Nolan, in prepping for that film, was, like, screening things like Battleship Potemkin and Dr. Zhivago. And, like, once you have that sort of frame of reference, it's not hard to see the ways that, like, The Dark Knight Rises is sort of, like, aping and referencing these other pictures in, you know, in its construction. But all of it is done with this sort of politically neutral message,
right?
Where it's like, it's in fact the image of, like, class solidarity and people taking to the streets is of a bunch of cops marching up toward, I think, the stock exchange.
Yeah, I think
might be City Hall, but, like, literally that's the big, like, climactic confrontation.
Right.
Is, like, you know, a bunch of cops in dress blues charging heavily armed. Whatever the fuck Bane's army is. Like, what do they stand for? I don't know. They're League of Shadows.
The League of Shadows. Love? Equality? Not really?
Just chaos for chaos's sake.
Yeah.
But it was basically this idea of, like, people find the imagery of these things compelling. Because these images have power, because they become symbolic of movements and moments that they're associated with. But then people get just allure, like, hypnotized by the allure of the image itself, and they just want the imagery divorced from any of that context that originally gave it power. And I think this is the frustrating thing about sort of the way people freely appropriate imagery and scenarios that are historically resonant, is because what you are contributing to is this idea that, for instance, like, Ricky Gervais carrying a fucking microphone like a cross.
Oh my God.
Like, that the new atheism is somehow comparable with the Passion of the Christ, right? That those are somehow two things that can be equated via an image, that you can make one equal one.
Right. I mean, like, we opened this podcast by talking about our frustrations with the discourse around civility this week, and the images that the right has been bringing up in response to members of an administration who are actively separating families, or who have been actively separating families, comparing them being politely asked to leave in one instance a restaurant because literally the people who work at that restaurant are the sorts of folks who are targeted by those policies, comparing those to civil rights, to Jim Crow laws in the era of the civil rights marches, and to the recent case with the cake maker in Utah. Is that Colorado? In Colorado. Like, that sort of, like, mapping, that sort of, like, the draining of content, the retention of an image, of the spectacle, and then the mapping onto, like a fucking overhead display, like a transparency that you just have the sketch of. Like, oh, well, now we're the ones who are being hurt here. You're right, is, like, so detrimental to the state of discourse, because now you're just, like, boxing shadows. You're not talking about the meat of the thing or how those two things actually are meaningfully different.
It's like this distinct... Well, oh, sorry.
Go for it.
I was just going to say, it's this very distinctly, like, sneering postmodern sort of way of looking at the world versus the having feelings and being caring, like, and being very modernist in your approach to the universe.
But it's even wild, because, like, those people will say that we are the ones who are the postmodernists for whom there is no truth, even as they discard truth, right? That's, like, the Jordan Peterson line. Rob, what were you?
Yeah, it's just, like, this idea that if you can create an image, like, that if somehow you can sort of stage a moment where you can change the framing, where you are now in the position that because of culture, because of like popular memory, if you can position yourselves aesthetically in the position that oppressed people on the side of righteousness once stood, that you can then somehow claim, you know, by this like transitive power of aesthetic, their cause and their righteousness, right? That like, you know, if like that fucking boy, she's taking her 15 minutes, but that Kent State open carry.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Like this whole idea of like, you know, once again, it's just, you know, some brave young activist standing up for her beliefs on, you know, the grounds of Kent State.
Yeah, fuck off.
And that's the same thing, right? Because it's Kent State again. It's, you know, it's an unpopular, view.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's kind of how it all reads to me. It's like as we sort of use these images thoughtlessly or to make them a little more resonant and powerful because they don't have meaning in of themselves in the way we're appropriating them, we are leeching the original thing of its meaning in popular memory and making it easier to
it
be.
It turns it into an ice level.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, and like, and maybe here's...
It's not like the American flag is not just like, oh, we need a fire level. So it's like, you mix, it's like, no, like... But that's essentially like what a lot of this does, like what Rob's saying, when you sap it of meaning, of context, of symbolism, of importance, you're left with just aesthetic trappings as though they didn't mean anything in the first place, and you're just swapping in X to Y because... Well, you need to look at something
totally
different.
Well, like, and here is the challenge, I think. If you're listening to this and are in the world of artistic production, especially if you're in the world of video game production, if you're developing games, the challenge that I would leave you with is that instead of only looking at ways to – we've been talking about two cases so far. We've been talking about cases in which a game apes the iconography of a real political movement but does not copy any of the kind of political weight behind it. We've been talking about cases where they do both, where they both bring on the politics and the iconography. What I would love to see from game developers is the creation of new iconography that bleeds out the other direction, right? Like there is a degree to which, you know, the end of the Benjamin piece on the aura, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction ends with him basically saying like, hey, look, the fascists, they have aestheticized politics, right? They have taken all of their political stuff and turned it into banners and turned it into posters and into recorded speech and into taglines and into catchphrases and into little pamphlets you can carry around and have made it aesthetic, has turned it into aesthetic objects that communicate the holistic, terrible, like truth of the Nazi Empire. We should do the opposite and politicize the aesthetic. And he doesn't like – that doesn't turn into, sadly, here's 10 BuzzFeed article, 10 ways to politicize the aesthetic.
Cool ways. Yeah.
But if you're in the world of game development, I think that and are politically active and want to engage with this, not just engage with it enough
and you're
that you're
in a
not,
position of power where you can make these creative decisions.
Totally.
Which I think is the worst.
Yeah, or at least
– this is where the biggest disconnect might
totally,
be.
Totally, but yeah. Or at least in a position where you can – engage and push
or
and push and
it.
Advocate.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Consider it a challenge to make stuff that we want to carry from games into the real world, right? Not just the aping of the political stuff that's already out in the world, but make an ice level not in the sense that it's just another ice level, but in that Patrick and Danielle and Rob and I all know exactly what he meant when he said an ice level. Do that for politics in your game. And you know, sometimes you're going to make a top-down shooter where, like, that's not maybe the vehicle that you can dig deep into that stuff. I'm not saying that games that fail to do this, but I'm saying if you're interested in this stuff, I would love to come away with a symbol. You know, I think it's funny they bring up the Jupiter Doomsday brings up Night in the Woods and, like, Night in the Woods is filled with political iconography, yet the one that I see taken away from most is like the character Greg doing his like crimes dance.
Yep.
And like, give me that, but like a little more praxis. You know? Crimes, but make it fashion, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
And I think that is actually an interesting challenge. I'd love to, in 5 years from now, be like, oh yeah, this symbol or this phrase originated from this really interesting game, that XYZ. And I think there's already some things that bleed in that direction, but I'd like to see even more of that.
Yeah.
All right. I think maybe that does it for us today. Rob?
One more thing, though.
Yeah!
Eve!
Yeah!
It's not like the Division 3 you're building toward, like, and in Division 3, we're going to give you answers about how to structure society so these crises don't happen again. Like, fuck off! Like, Division 3 is going to be fucking the Republic or something like that. Like, Division 3, you need to get to Polemarchus' safe house and figure out how to structure the society to be more just and to make sure the right kind of people rule it.
Well, what, like, if that, so counter argument, what if that's already the Division 2 and they're doing the thing that we feel like they're doing with Shadow of Tomb Raider, and they're just like, but we're never going to say that out loud. And that's the part that feels like it could be really detrimental to this, to part that's one of the things that could be detrimental here is I don't know how does Yzgamal respond to this in a way. I don't give a fuck about Yzgamal. He's the CEO of Ubisoft. He's living fine. But if you are a writer on a game like this, and right now you come out and you're like, you know, we think America is in a place where they are treading closer and closer to fascism, and we think that's a real problem, and blah blah blah. There, you're drawing a target on yourself, and this is not an excuse, but I am saying to some degree. The culture needs to be adjusted and needs to be pushed into the direction that we can have the sorts of conversations that film directors have. I think the way to do that is to start having those conversations and to do what journalists have been doing around Ubisoft stuff this year, which is pushing back and demanding more answers and more like genuine responses.
And also, if they talk about it more, then you're not – if everyone has a target on their back, then nobody has a target on their back. Like, part of the reason that there's such a vitriolic response from certain shitty segments of the internet when a developer or designer or whoever goes out on a limb and actually explains, like, the ideology behind what they're creating, what they're trying to say, is because they're going out on a limb, right? Like, it's a culture – like, a culture shift has to happen where –
That's
part
just of the
more
cycle.
Of an open conversation that people are having. Look at the difference between and part of this is like the audience of different sports, but like the way politics is discussed in the NBA versus the way politics is discussed in the NFL. Like the NBA, which like has a different set of audiences that are a little more left-leaning, is true. But it has a culture in which the reporters, the players, the coaches, the top-down, the owners, like the organizational, like the league-wide, it is a culture in which, like, politics is just what's going to talk about. So you'll see the occasional quote that, like, makes it through when, like, Popovich or someone says something really striking about, like, what's going on. But it doesn't create, like, an enormous, like, megaton-like reaction because that's just part of the culture. But in the NFL, partially because, you know, you have, you know, fuckwads like Trump, like, you know, picking, you know, deciding to pick a fight, and there's, like, a certain culture behind, like, the fans of the NFL. But that's just a culture where they don't talk about it. So in the same way, if everyone begins discussing it in this, like, larger sense, then it just becomes part of the conversation around video games rather than, like, one person going, like, ha-ha, like, I'm going to actually point out what's going on here.
There's also an element of, honestly, if I were writing for the Division 2, I wouldn't want to talk about it right now. Like, genuinely, I would want to, like, I would, if anything, I would like the work to be able to sort of spring its message via the, you know what I mean? Like, I would not want to be the brand of, like, we're going to speak truth to America in its current situation, because then it just turns into another culture war proxy, and I'm not sure, like, I would want my message to reach a fucking audience that maybe isn't coming there already knowing what they think of my story.
Right, but contrast that with the way film directors talk about their movies, right? Where, like, so the one that I pulled up really quick because I knew I would find it. I didn't have this. Yeah. This wasn't in my back pocket. I just literally was like, I wonder if Guillermo del Toro said stuff about Shape of the Water in this way. And so writing about or responding to a question about Shape of the Water, he says, regarding the fish monster man, yes, in that movie, if y'all have seen it, he is as other as it gets, and he is saved by the others, by the invisible, the silent, the nameless coming together to rescue him. That's a political statement, and that's all – that is being able to speak clearly about the thematic through lines of your work without saying the word – he doesn't say gay. He doesn't say queer there. He doesn't say disabled. He doesn't say black. That's what he means, and that is what that film supports, is that the characters who come to the aid of this fish person are a black woman, a disabled woman, and a queer man,
yeah,
right? And, like, that is the heart of that film is finding love and finding community in the margins at a time where America is at its most regressive and its most like troubled in some ways, right? And I mean the most troubled, but is it a troubled and regressive moment? And so like, I don't know that it is so much to expect that from, again, maybe not Yves Guillemot, who is a CEO and is, but from a creative director. Like, I don't know that that's such a high expectation. And I don't, I'm not, I don't.
Pete Hines says it.
Well, Pete Hines says fuck Nazis, which is easy to say.
Sort of, but like, if you actually read the quotes of the developers at Machine Games actually sort of backtrack from the Google position. And then it ends up undercutting the stuff that like ZeniMax or Bethesda, you know, like the corporate side of it, which then just feels like they're just like capitalizing on like popular sort of rhetoric as opposed to actually believing.
Yeah.
And like, I still like it. Say fuck Nazis on stage. Like, that's good. Like, that is a capital G good. But it's a little more. Anyway, Rob.
Part of me wonders if this is also a Hollywood versus games divide, though, where it's much safer to say this kind of thing in Hollywood.
Totally.
Versus the game industry, which is still perceived in a lot of ways as being a very immature, very conservative sort of place and world.
Totally.
Which is not to say that people shouldn't say,
no, but I think
fuck Nazis
there.
And we should be looking for, you know, unity in the margins. Like, those are good things to say. Those are important things to say, and I think people should say them. And I used the word cowardice earlier when talking about this. But I wonder if that's just sort of the result. And I would love to see people pushing against that. I would love to see people feeling like they can push against it and have like things like labor unions,
right,
so they feel
right.
like they can push against these things, and they won't lose their job for saying something like, "Yeah, you know what? Fuck this. This is fucked up." Or here's some ideology I put into this game. I'm a writer. Or I'm a level like, designer. Here's something I wanted to say.
I don't even think anyone needs the here's the ideology I want to put in the game. Here's a message.
Just mean, like, let me articulate this,
right,
or feel comfortable articulating that.
I feel like creative directors, narrative designers, writers, artists, like level designers, are all such creative people, and many of them are deeply capable of speaking eloquently about the ideas that go into their designs and that go into their writing and that go into their work. They have not been asked these questions. They have not received media training on good responses in a lot of cases. I know for a fact that there are PR agents who are like, what is happening right now in this space? Because we were just at E3 and talked to people who are surprised by the response to this stuff because it hasn't been an issue, because it hasn't been a talking point. We got real good at how do the guns feel.
Mm-hmm.
We got real good at what's the progression mechanic like? How many levels
what's
are there?
What's your release date?
What's your release date? how many classes are there? I don't want to be clear. We got really good at how do you make a compelling cover-based shooter in a field where there's lots of – that's an interesting question. I'm not taking away from – how did you get that feeling of flight in Anthem where it feels like it's like a little shaky? That's a cool question. I'm not saying get rid of that question. But we haven't made developers answer these questions until now. And I think that the industry will get better for it, and you'll even see people who are really good at answering those sorts of questions. And I think that we'll hopefully see that conversation continue to happen. Rob, you had one more.
No, I
note
think
here.
It's more that I'm just thinking of the comparison to like Del Toro speaking about Shape of Water, and isn't he speaking at that point though? By the time like there's a movie that he can refer to that people have seen, and he's interpreting, he's discussing the text of the film that is now out there and people are reacting to. He's joining in a discussion that can now actually happen.
Totally, totally. But press tours are filled with this sort of thing in film.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely will talk about what the big picture ideas that they wanted to hit were. And they won't be as – I mean, this is a very textual answer that was about like the last third of the film. So yes. But we also don't see that in games, right?
No, and that's why like these answers have been bad, and they've been like aggressively naive to the point they're like infuriatingly disingenuous. But I think for me it's more like, so I'm playing The Division 1 right now, and something that I think would like I think the reveal that, like, there's this last man battalion in the game that is all the, like, basically the private law enforcement, private military contractors, all the one percenters, the minute the shit hits the fan, call in their own security forces to look after their interests. And then while they're there, they decide,
fuck it,
fascism makes a lot of sense. And they go for it. And that's kind of your big bad in the division. That slowly, like, that picture comes into focus over the course of the division, which is actually kind of a cool reveal. You don't run into these guys right away. They're not positioned as, like, you know, the people in the big tower in the middle of the map you've got to fight. Like, you know, their revelation as the main, like, antagonist sort of emerges over the course of the game. And I guess that's kind of what I mean by, like, that's the kind of text that I'm not sure can be foreshadowed so effectively in a press tour.
But that's only because they fucked up that game, Rob. Because 12 hours before that, I killed a black woman who was saying Black Lives Matter. In her fucking prison oranges. Like, a game that's actually coherent, a game that actually has a through line that is about what happens when the world falls apart, what happens in our moments of crisis, how do people who can, if they actually stick the landing on that stuff, and if as Eve suggests, this games are supposed to be a place for us to experiment and explore perspectives and fill in the gaps of their own understanding and consider, you know, positions that we don't traditionally do, then they can have that more general through line, and they can make the case, well, in the division, we're imagining a world that's falling apart, and we're trying to understand, we're trying to look at the ways in which the positions you already held before a crisis impact the way that you handle yourself and handle community and survival after the crisis hits. That's not hard. I bullshitted that 10 seconds ago. They made that game for 3 years. If there is a clear, coherent through line, if they're not, the Last Man Battalion stuff is rad. Like, I actually love the end of the division for that reason. And I also think that mechanically it all comes together there. But because the rest of that game is just fucking flailing, and because it doesn't do any of the shit that Eve says he wants his games to do, he wants Ubisoft's games to do, which are about looking at different perspectives, they can't come out and say that stuff. And because it would be a spoiler, because what you're saying is true. But, like, it didn't have to be that way. It could have been another way. And I hope with the Division 2 they're able to do that. They've had that response. People have said that it feels so strange to have us spend the first, you know, 25 hours of that game killing poor people and black people and you know, city workers, and then to suddenly pivot to, like, and to do that without any – there's never a moment where, like, oh, shit, we've been killing the wrong people for the last 30 hours. There's never a, like, ah, if only we could have talked our way out of that one. It's just the thing you do. You left trigger, right trigger. And it's so frustrating to me to foreclose the possibility that they could have done better there, because they could have, and it would have been, you know, I think a lot of people would have been like, man, they really stuck the landing. And instead, not so much. Sorry to, like, blow up at you there, but, like, it's all right there. It's all right there. And just, like...
No, sir. And to be fair, like, at this point, my experience with the division is so compromised by I've heard about the end game before I've gotten to it.
Right.
So right now, like when I'm hearing the radio messages being like, you know, there's this last man battalion, here's what they're up to, I'm like, ah, effective foreshadowing. I see there's a larger game afoot in New York. And then it's like, now go murder these Rikers. And I'm like, yeah, all right.
Well, even in the audio messages in that game were wild, because it's like, that's felt like a Band-Aid being added. There's definitely one of those radio messages where it's like, you heard the Riker, the people have got out of Rikers. And then, like, their fake Alex Jones is like, yeah, but most of them are in there for, like, marijuana charges.
I ended up there myself once.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's like, maybe we shouldn't kill all them. Like, if you gave me the option, I would go another way. All right, I think we're going to eject on this one. We're way past our time.
Yes. For the third time.
You can follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people follow you, Danielle?
At Danielle or I.
How about you, Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
Patrick? Follow everything at Waypoint Patrick does. Patrick. Twitter.com/Waypoint, Facebook.com/Waypoint, Vice, YouTube.com/Waypoint, Vice, and Twitch.tv/Waypoint. Obviously, you can go to waypoint.vice.com for all of our stories and everything else that we do. And thanks shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Panel Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. If you have thoughts about this stuff, swing by our forums. You can go to discourse.zone for those. I think that's a good place to go. Shout outs to the mods for all the work that they do. All right, everybody. Oh, deep breath. Yeah. Deep breath out. I'm going to go get some more water. Danielle, what do we tell them?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
I give the red hen 3 Pinocchios.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.